I hope that some of you have RSVs, some of you have Good News or Today's English Version, and some of you have King James. Is there at least one King James among us? The older translation? Okay, I need an Old Testament King James. And I think all of those Bibles marked Gideon are King James. All right, good, because I want to refer to a translation that's in the King James Version near the outset. Well, I think we can begin. Good morning to all of you. The task for this morning is to compare and contrast two biblical ideas, mercy and justice. This has been a particular interest of mine in the last few years because it seems that much of what we do in the world, much of our ethical conduct, our behavioral response to God's grace tends to fall it tends to go either in the category of justice or the category of mercy. And a little later I want to chart a comparison of those two concepts on the board, and I think that'll become clear. I want to go through some biblical material first. But the basic thesis of this Bible study is that we would rather respond to the needs of others in the world. When we're thinking of that in our Christian discipleship, we'd rather respond in the category of mercy, or charity it's sometimes called, or being good to people out of a basis that says, this is what I choose to do, this is what I do voluntarily, than we would out of a category that says, this is what is required of us. We don't like very much the idea of requirement. Another way of saying that is we would rather we choose to do to people who are undeserving than to do what is deserved or required or expected. Let me share this as part of the introduction before we go to the biblical material. A recent study paper, a discussion paper, prepared for congregations of the American Lutheran Church is this little document called Loving in Deed and in Truth. The assignment was to try to define why it is that so many Lutherans, so many Lutheran congregations, find it difficult to engage in social justice work. Part of the analysis of the problem goes like this. Lutherans have been exemplary in their dedication to social service, and we continue to maintain an unusually high number of caring institutions and agencies and specialized chaplaincies. We have been unusually visible in ministries which bind up the wounds of victims created by human social disorder, both domestically and internationally. But if we are ready to engage in social service, we have been reluctant to deal with social change or social adjusting, reform, advocacy, justice. We have not easily entered the arena of social and political reordering, nor do we invest significant resources of the church in battling systemic injustice. We have abandoned this more prophetic activity to other groups. Then the study paper goes on and tries to explore why that is so, both culturally, historically, in this society, and biblically, on the basis of the particular Lutheran formation from Europe to North America. I have copies of this for all of you who are interested, and I'll distribute them later. I think you may find it interesting. It has a mechanism for discussion in a group, in a congregation, as part of the document. So I began to look at what is the biblical relationship between mercy and justice, between charity or graceful, unrequired service or response to the needs of people, and on the other hand, what is required by the law, by the demands of justice. The interesting thing is that sometimes, biblically, those two diverge, and sometimes they converge. They come back together and get mixed, intermixed, in the same kind of language. The same words tend to take on a little bit of the character of each. I'd like to begin then biblically with a couple of Old Testament passages. One is Micah 6:8, a very familiar passage in which the prophet summarizes what is expected of the faithful ones in the covenant. It's a kind of summary statement that I think you're familiar with and that is a useful jumping off point. And if somebody has it in the King James, I'd appreciate having it read in that version. Micah 6:8. Would you read it, please? Okay, what does the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to do justice, it's sometimes translated, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. There you have the idea of justice and the idea of mercy and the idea of humility all brought together in one summary statement. Apparently, the original language there has distinctive words for the idea of justice and the idea of mercy, and that is true. That's the way it comes out in English. That's the way it is in the original Hebrew. In other Old Testament passages, however, justice and love, or justice and mercy, justice and graciousness, grace, compassion, seem to be used in parallel. An example of that is Deuteronomy 10, 18 and 19. If someone will look for that in the Revised Standard Version, I will share it from the Jerusalem Bible. Let's hear it first from the Revised Standard Version. Deuteronomy 10, 18 and 19. All right. He executes justice and, what's the rest of it? Loves the sojourner. And always when that is, when the sojourner, the alien, the resident alien is mentioned in the Old Testament material, there's a reminder that the people of Israel are to be kind, loving, and just to the sojourner because they too were sojourners. They too were aliens. In the Jerusalem Bible, it reads like this. It is He, that is Yahweh, who sees justice done for the orphan and the widow, who loves the stranger and gives him food and clothing. Love the stranger then, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I want to go back now to some of the biblical words in Hebrew and Greek and how they have been handled by translators and how they have come down to us informing our consciousness about biblical understandings of mercy and justice. The first key word in the Hebrew is the word for mercy, or chesed, C-H-E-S-E-D. That word is very frequent in the Hebrew scriptures, and it's usually translated in the King James Version as loving kindness, God's attitude of loving kindness toward us. I guess that goes back to the Coverdale translation, at least it goes back before the King James day, and the King James translation, which most of us grew up with, is loving kindness. What is it in the Revised Standard Version? The translators of the RSV made a change there, and instead of translating chesed as loving kindness, they use what phrase? Any of you recall? They use the phrase steadfast love. In both translations, it is the idea of God's unwavering, continuing forbearance and faithfulness in keeping the covenant, in keeping His side of the covenant. It has the flavor of pity and compassion. Not justice in the sense of what is right or what is deserved, because if God were totally just in dealing with the unfaithful people, they would be under condemnation. We would be under condemnation. But it's the idea of, despite our unfaithfulness, despite our transgression, God's pity and compassion for us in our weakness and our helplessness. In the Old Testament, it is seldom related to atonement or forgiveness or the idea of salvation. It is related to the covenant relationship and God's continuing steadfast love or loving kindness or grace, we could say, His graciousness in dealing with a faithless people. It has to do with relationships. It has to do with being in right relationships. God with His people, and then by extension, His people are expected to practice chesed, or mercy, in their dealings with one another. the Old Testament word for justice has a somewhat different flavor. It is the second word on the board, tzedek, or sometimes tzedekah, S-E-D-A-Q-A-H. It means originally the norm. The norm, and the norm is seen to be in the character of God, who is the righteous one. Tzedek is often translated righteousness, and it's sometimes translated justice, but it really means the same thing. Righteousness, again, is a right set of relationships. It is also the ability to make judgments. The one who judges, the one who makes judgments, is the righteous one. It deals with the vindication of the helpless. God's righteousness on behalf of those who are oppressed or helpless. God's people then are called to the same kind of conduct. In the Old Testament especially, God is seen as especially active on behalf of the poor and the orphan and the widow and again the alien. And so we, the faithful followers, are to be. Isaiah 58 is an interesting section of the prophetic literature because it deals with what is expected in terms of righteousness of the people in the covenant. Apparently the people had been following the external requirement of fasting. They had been doing what was expected. They had been keeping the fast, but it was meaningless because their lives didn't reflect the relationship with the righteous one in terms of their relationships to one another, in terms of their dealing justly with each other. Look at Isaiah 58, the first 10 verses. We'll read it in a couple of translations again. Who has it in the Revised Standard Version or Good News? Does anybody have it in Good News, today's English version? All right, would you read verses 1 through 4 in today's English version? All right, let me continue with it in the Jerusalem Bible. Fasting like yours today will never make your voice heard on high. Is that the sort of fast that pleases me? A truly penitential day? Hanging your head like a reed, lying down on sackcloth and ashes? Is that what you call fasting, a day acceptable to Yahweh? Is not this the sort of fast that pleases me? It is the Lord Yahweh who speaks. To break unjust fetters, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke, to share your bread with the hungry, and to shelter the homeless poor. To clothe the man you seem to see to be naked, and not turn from your own kin. Then will your light shine like the dawn, and your wound be quickly healed over. So God is saying, if you are in relationship with me, it is to be exhibited, demonstrated, acted out in terms of your relationships with one another. Employers with workers, family members with their own kin. In one of the translations it says, don't turn yourself away from your own relatives. I think maybe that's in the RSV, which makes it a little clearer than don't turn away from your own flesh or from your own kin. And then there is a promise associated with it. It is not just law or requirement, but the promise is there. If you behave thusly, your dawn, your light will shine like dawn. The glory of Yahweh will go behind you. Cry and Yahweh will answer. Call and he will say, I am here. If you do away with the yoke, the clenched fist, the wicked word, if you give your bread to the hungry and relief to the oppressed, your light will rise in the darkness, and your shadows become like noon. Yahweh will always guide you, giving you relief in desert places. So the key in the understanding of justice or tzedek in the Old Testament is relationships, not an abstract keeping of a legal code or an exercise like the fast, but God's rightness demands righteousness or justice in return. and the promise is there. There's a gradual development in the Hebrew use of tzedak toward mercy or benevolence or compassion, going beyond the mere judicial requirement of the law, toward grace meanings and salvation meanings. But most of the Old Testament use of tzedak is in the sense that we would use the English word justice. One more Old Testament passage that's quite rich is Psalm 72, verses 1 through 14. Let's hear that in the Revised Standard Version. Psalm 72, verses 1 through 14. It's an interesting mixture of the emphasis on the nations of the world coming to be servant to this king. By the way, this psalm is traditionally understood to be about Solomon at the beginning of Solomon's rule. There's the emphasis on the other kings of the earth paying homage to this king, and then this king ruling in such a way that that who are served? Who gets special attention? Who among the people gets special attention? The poor, the hungry, the needy, the oppressed. It is also the righteousness or justice of God that is prayed for, that is to become that of the king. Give the king your justice, O God. there are other psalms that have a similar kind of character about them. In fact, some of the psalms talk about the justice which nature has a right to expect, just relationship between human beings and nature. And maybe we can return to that a little bit later. When we move to the New Testament, the word that is used for justice is dikaiosune, dikaiosune. And it's usually translated in the older versions, righteousness, and in the newer, justice. And most scholars say that the two words are really interchangeable. You can use the word righteousness or justice, and when you find righteousness, you can substitute justice, and vice versa, in the English translation. It is the Greek word used in the Septuagint, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures, the Greek word used for tzedak. In the New Testament writings, it is the word used for the phrase translated righteousness of God. When you have in Matthew, seek first the kingdom of God and its righteousness, the word there is dikaiosune. It is also seen as the ethical standard of conduct that's expected of believers. It is God's righteousness, and then by extension, it is what is expected of the believers. It is justice, but it also takes on the flavor of more than simple justice. And let me give you some examples. One of the first uses chronologically in the Gospels of the word by Jesus is in Matthew 3:15. Jesus, toward the beginning of his ministry, is talking with John the Baptist. Then Jesus appeared. He came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. John tried to dissuade him. "It is I who need baptism from you," he said, "and yet you come to me." But Jesus replied, "Leave it like this for the time being. It is fitting that we should, in this way, do all that righteousness demands." At this, John gave in to him. All that is required in God's design is the meaning there of what righteousness requires. All that is a part of the righteousness of God, or the design of God, or the plan of God, the will of God. In Matthew, a lot of these passages will come from Matthew, because Matthew uses a great deal the idea of the righteousness or the justice of God. Let's look next at Matthew 5:20. And could we have that read from any version, whoever has it? Okay, that's a recurring theme in Jesus' teaching, especially in Matthew and the Sermon on the Mount, that the righteousness of the believers in the New Covenant is to go beyond that the standard of righteousness or justice which is practiced by those who are the exemplary, faithful followers of the law, the scribes and the Pharisees. It has the flavor of justice and more, or human understandings of justice and more, or the old covenant understanding of justice and beyond. Matthew 6:33. Would someone read that? Okay, now there, if you substitute the word justice for righteousness, I think it gives you a little different flavor. And the scholars say that you can use either word interchangeably. The idea of the justice of the kingdom is what is being talked about there. What is the justice of the kingdom? Well, let me attempt a summary of all of this material that we've gone at rather sketchily and quickly. There are about three levels that you can look at in terms of justice in the biblical material. The first level is that the character of God as the just one is the touchstone. That is the departure point. The understanding of the justice of God or the righteousness of God emanates from the character of God himself. God is the just one, and that's the benchmark. Then secondly, there is a demand for just conduct among the faithful. In the Old Testament covenant, the justice of God, the righteousness of God, is to be practiced by the people of God. And then in the New Testament, especially in Jesus, you start to get that idea of righteousness which goes beyond basic justice. Righteousness or justice that is second mile or turning the other cheek, that is the ethic of the kingdom, the new covenant, that goes beyond the justice understanding of the Old Testament law. That all tends to get somewhat confusing. It gets even, I think, a little more complex when you introduce St. Paul, who uses the same language, the same Greek words, dikaiosune, and the verb form of that, to talk about justification. Justification is a way of talking about the salvation which God brings in declaring to be just or right those who are not. In saying, you're okay when we aren't okay. In saying, because of the sacrifice of Christ and the resurrection of Christ, we are now declared justified or declared just when we are not just. All of it uses the same Greek word or words. So justification is related to God's justice. And if you can make that jump, that leap in your minds, it is saying that those who are not just are just for purposes of salvation. So it is not by accident that in the English, justice, justification, justify, and just have similar meanings or are related. They are related. They are also related in the Greek. What I'd like to do now is depart from the biblical material and go to an analysis of the relationship between justice and mercy as we tend to understand those words today. Bill Lazarus, who is a Lutheran ethicist, writes that justice is a way of loving people when you have more than one person to love. Justice is a way of creating an order or a system, a pattern, a set of relationships, arrangements, when you have more than one person to love. So justice, in Lazarus' understanding, is one form of loving. Justice makes love ordered, not dependent on whim or goodwill or my feeling toward you that day. It makes it more dependable. And so justice in that sense is more than mercy. It is more than my good feeling toward you, which depends on my mercifulness or my graciousness. What I'd like to do now is chart some of those contrasting understandings of mercy and justice, between mercy and justice, on the board. And I'm going to put some down, and then we'll talk a little bit about them and look at some additional biblical material in a couple of cases. Let me put these on the board, and I'll be right back. I need to talk from over here so that it gets on the tape. What I've done here is to set up some contrast between mercy and justice, possibly oversimplified, possibly stereotyping, but let it be. the suggestion is that as we normally use those two concepts, they can be distinguished one from the other. And what I want to come to in a moment, after we run through this this set of parallel columns, is the conclusion that neither of those is the positive and the other the negative, that both are valid, both are valuable, and that you can even argue that mercy is more than justice and justice is more than mercy, that both are true, and that's the paradox, and that's what I want to come to as the kind of bottom line of all of this. Mercy we associate with the understanding of grace. Justice we understand with law. If those are dualities in the biblical material, well, justice and mercy go with those two poles. Mercy, to say it another way, is in the area of what is undeserved, of what cannot be compelled, of what cannot be required. Justice, however, is usually understood to be what is deserved, what is required, what is expected, what is right. Mercy fits more the category of charity or compassion, whereas justice has to do with rights. Mercy, we can say, is not fair. It is not what humanly understood is qualifies for the label fairness. Justice, however, has to do with fairness. In fact, if you need an equivalent for justice, another English word for it, I think fairness is as good a word as any. Can any of you think of a biblical story that illustrates how mercy or grace or compassion is not fair, and how others in the story understand it to be unfair to them? I can think of at least two parables Jesus told. Exactly, the late workers in the vineyard. What happens in that story? The first workers who come and work a full day agreed to a certain wage, right? Possible meanings in that parable, or possible reasons Jesus told it. I believe the basic reason he told it was to illustrate grace. Grace, in a human sense, is not fair. It gives to the undeserving what they don't deserve. And that's not fair. That's not justice. So that's an illustration of how mercy or grace is more than justice. It is bigger than justice. It goes beyond what is just. That's another one. That's the other one I had in mind. The story of the prodigal, or the forgiving father who welcomes home the undeserving son and shows him mercy. Not justice. If he'd shown him justice, he would have received something else. Justice is what the second son wanted him to get, wanted the elder brother to get. But justice is not what was given. What was given was mercy, grace, chesed. Okay. Mercy tends to deal with casualties or victims. It is, at least in the sense of charity, gracious behavior toward those who've been victimized, it tends to deal with casualties. Whereas justice tends to be about the root causes that create casualties. What is it that creates victimization? Mercy would perhaps, to use a contemporary equivalent, have to do with getting food to people in some immediate relief sense. Or perhaps in our society, in our system, sharing food through food stamps, or Meals on Wheels, or congregate dining for the elderly, or something like that. Justice would raise questions about why are there unemployed people, or why are there people who do not have their own resources for getting food, for buying food. Now, again, I say both columns are important, both are necessary, both are part of what response people need to make in a given situation. I don't want to judge one against the other. I don't want to put down charity as a bad word. But they are different. So mercy has, as a kind of response, more characteristically social service, bandaging up the wounds of people who've been hurt by the system. That seems to fit, in my mind, the category of mercy or compassion. Whereas justice has to do with trying to ensure that there aren't as many victims or as many wounded people, as many hurt people, by making social changes. Mercy is related to sharing, with an emphasis on voluntary sharing, at least in the way human beings deal with that. Justice has to do with structural change, change in the structures or systems which guide the relationships of human beings. Now, a biblical passage which I think picks that up is a word from Jesus in Matthew 23, 23rd chapter, the 23rd verse. And again, it's in the context of talking about righteousness or justice of the disciples going beyond that which is shown by the scribes and the Pharisees. Let's look at it in a number of versions because the translations vary. Who has it in the Revised Standard Version? Matthew 23:23. Okay, the idea of tithing, and in this use of mint and cumin and dill, those are seasoning herbs. And the basic requirement in the Old Testament was that the agricultural society tithe the cereal grains and other food items, but not the seasoning herbs weren't included. They were too minor. And here Jesus is saying, you hypocrites, you even tithe mint and dill and cumin. Tithing meant to share one-tenth, of course. And I think we could say a contemporary equivalent of that practice would be our voluntary sharing. They were going beyond what the law required in their tithing, but they were neglecting the weightier matters of the law. And in this version, which you read, it's justice, mercy, and faith. In some translations, it's justice, mercy, and honesty, or fairness, I think. Does anybody have it that way? What is the Good News version, today's English version? Justice, mercy, and honesty. Okay. Let's move on. Mercy has to do with what we have called diaconal work, the diaconate, the work of immediate service to human need, as the church has understood that through establishing hospitals, through doing resettlement of refugees, through doing feeding of the hungry. Direct response to human need is diaconal work. Justice, more characteristically, has to do with political activity, which has to do with power relationships, with structural and system change. That's another distinction. If we were to put this in the context of international relations, mercy or voluntary sharing would call for more aid from the rich nations to the poor nations, more foreign assistance. What would justice call for? What might you set up in contrast to more aid as a way of relating? You often hear nations say, third world nations say, we don't want more charity from you, we want better trade. I think if you want words that rhyme, you could put alongside more aid, fairer trade, because very often it's posed in exactly that way. More aid may be necessary in the short run, I think it is, of a certain kind, good quality of aid, but in the long run, what the poor nations are calling for is fairer trade. Relationships, trade arrangements, and other kinds of international economic arrangements that give them a fairer deal. Okay, that's another way of talking about the contrast. Still another would be that in mercy, understood as our voluntary sharing, we decide. We, the donors, decide when to do that. We decide when to extend it. Just as God ultimately decides whether or not to be gracious, we cannot require it of Him. We cannot say this is expected. You have to do this. We know that God is the one who does treat us graciously, but we cannot compel it. So in a relationship of compassion or charity or mercy, humanly understood, the one who extends it is the one who decides and remains in control of when and how to do it. Just as we every year decide in our Congress whether and how much foreign aid to give. In the justice category, we give up that kind of control. We no longer decide because it becomes part of the justice system. We relinquish We don't decide, we relinquish. We let go of control. Finally, to use some biblical language, you could say that mercy is second mile, or turning the other cheek response. It is contrasted with justice, which is about first mile, or one cheek response. So, the conclusion of this would be that justice is more than mercy, since mercy cannot be required. Justice can be, once it's written into the system which guides a set of human beings, justice can be required. It can be appealed to as what we have promised to do with one another. Justice is what can be expected once it's written into law. It can be demanded as one's right. Is security part of justice or part of mercy in our society? It's part of justice because we've written it into law and we've made a promise, a covenant with one another that we will keep that promise. I would say, likewise, any part of the welfare system, any part of public income maintenance, once it's written into law, is part of the justice system. We may question whether it's just in every case, and we do, but it is no longer a part of mercy or compassion. There may have been mercy or compassion behind the legislation, but once it becomes written into the system of law, it is part of the justice column. So justice is what can be expected. It's what is fair. It can be demanded as one's right. But mercy is also more than justice. And this is where the paradox comes. Because mercy goes beyond what is merely deserved. The late workers in the vineyard, the forgiving father in the parable of the prodigal. Mercy is more than justice. It is second mile. It is turning the other cheek. It is doing more than the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. And the Christian, it seems to me, needs to move in both of these realms all the time and between the two. Not saying, well, the call to Christian discipleship is to respond in the column of mercy or grace and neglect justice, as though we should not be concerned with things political or how the arrangements among people in our society, our social order, are put together. I think the biblical call is to be involved in both. But we also ought never be satisfied with simply the justice column and not going beyond, because then the reality of grace among us, the grace that we receive from God, the way we deal with one another, does not have that character of grace about it. Grace or mercy goes beyond justice. At the risk of confusing you even more, let me give you one illustration of what I think is a legal example of grace. That is, where in our system of law, in the Western countries at least, and maybe in among all people, where do we have an example of legal grace? Of grace that goes beyond, or of law that goes beyond what the law normally requires, or what the demands of justice would require? Can you think there is a category of law that is gracious? No, that's not what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of the normal criminal justice system. Amnesty. Amnesty is legal grace. That is, amnesty is never required. You cannot demand it. If you are in a category of people who have committed a crime or are suspected of being guilty of a crime, you cannot say, I demand amnesty. You have to give me amnesty. Usually amnesty is given for a political crime of some kind, not for a crime of violence. But the system, the state, the government, the judicial system may always extend amnesty if it wishes. It is not required, but a society may grant it. Amnesty is not like pardon. Pardon is after a conviction occurs, when mercy is extended, or we sometimes call it commutation of sentence. That would be a form of pardon. Amnesty is done before there is even a conviction. And it is literally legal forgetfulness. It is to forget that the crime occurred, to forget to prosecute. Well, amnesty is legal grace. I think amnesty is a legal parallel to mercy. It is the law being merciful when it doesn't have to be. It is not required. And you can never say that amnesty must be done. You can say that a society may choose to do amnesty for very good reasons. Yes. If our government would choose to release the Iranian bank assets which are held in this country, would that be called mercy or justice? Well, what do you think? Does that mean required by some body of law, international or domestic? Or do you mean justice in a larger sense, that in the total context of the conflict between our country and Iran, the present rulers of Iran, justice requires that kind of movement, that kind of gesture, that kind of offering? You could also ask about an admission of responsibility on the part of this country for past error in dealing with the Iranian people because of our support of the Shah. Would that be compassion, mercy, or would that be justice? But not justice in the sense that it's written down anywhere in law that we have to do that. Justice in the sense of the larger framework of what is required. Yeah. Okay. We don't have much time left. What I'd like to do in the remaining moments is ask you to think about how we understand justice or fairness today in human society. Essentially, I said justice can be called fairness. To get to fairness, what is basically required, I think, is that we forget group identities. And that's very hard to do. It's easy to talk about, but it's hard to do. If you want to fashion a human order, an international human order, which is fair and just, it really requires setting aside my group ties, my group allegiances, my Americanness, my economic class, my age, even my faith group, I think. It requires getting beyond reserving any privileges for groups I belong to. That's what justice requires. We are unfair when we dwell on our particular situation and try to fashion a society or a body of law that will protect any advantages that I may have. Which is another way of saying that fashioning justice requires moving beyond immediate self-interest. A writer who has spent a lot of time on these issues is John Rawls. In his book, A Theory of Justice, he has a thought experiment for his readers, which goes like this. A group of people is to create a just society from scratch. There are no givens. You're given a blank sheet of paper and you're to start fresh and create the arrangements by which a society could live in justice. But there's a veil of ignorance present. It is that the members don't know in advance what place they will have in the new society. Nobody knows what position they will occupy, whether they will be high or low, whether they will be producers, owners of businesses, consumers, whatever. They don't know that in advance. So their task is to arrange the society's rules and responsibilities and rewards in a manner that safeguards the interests of everybody. Put differently, the task is to assure that society's benefits and burdens are borne fairly. If you were given that assignment, what characteristics would the society have? What kinds of safeguards would you build in? What would be the criteria for fashioning a society that would be just? Care for each other. How would you write that into the system to help ensure that? Would you take from the better off and give to the less well off? Would you redistribute income in some way? Would that be a part of your ideal society? Into land? Okay, how would you distribute the land initially? Would you like to have a lot of owners or a few owners of land? Okay, you'd like to have land ownership distributed widely. Okay, anything else? Okay, you'd have proscription of or laws against violence to one another. All right, you'd build in some kind of incentive then, I hear. Yeah, all right. Basic tension today, if you want to oversimplify, which I will do, between market capitalist systems and socialist systems is right at that point. Market capitalism tends to elevate incentive and individual freedom to achieve economic success beyond equity or equality in distribution of resources. Socialism tends to go the other way and elevate equality beyond individual freedom and incentive. And I think the world is still waiting for the ideal combination of those two that seems to combine private incentive or personal right to achieve and ascend economically with equity and equality and economic justice in that sense. And I don't know that anybody has come up with the ideal solution. We perhaps never will. But that, I think, is what the basic difference is between socialism and capitalism. How you view incentive on the one hand and equality or equity on the other hand. I think that's behind Rawls' insistence that there's a veil of ignorance. You don't know in advance what role you'll occupy. And that's really the golden rule. Do unto others as you would want to be done to if you were in their position. Because you don't know what position you're going to be in this society. That's a kind of golden rule approach, isn't it? Do unto others as you would have them do to you. Any other criteria for this society? Under international law and domestic law today, such understandings of technology, of ways of doing things, is called intellectual property. And you can put a patent on intellectual property. And you're arguing that that ought to be shared as the common property of all human beings. Okay? I think there are some problems in that, but that's, there are third world nations in particular say that that's the way we ought to go. That ought not to be protected for the advantage of those who are already advantaged. Let me ask a final question in closing. It is often said in our society by Christians that we ought to return to a pattern where charity was the basic way of taking care of the poor rather than governmental arrangements of law, which are basically income transfers in our culture, in our society. How sad it is that we no longer take care of each other out of one-to-one or small group loving relationships, which we call charity. How do you feel about that? And in your ideal society, what would you want to have as the pattern? In other words, would you like to return to the time when the sojourners, we used to call them tramps, the hobos in the 30s coming through our towns, were fed by coming for a handout, or the poor family in town got food from the non-poor as a gift, as part of compassion and charity. Would you like to return to that, or would you prefer the system we now have with all of its problems? But when it becomes part of the tax system rather than the voluntary charity system, do we also lose something? Okay, so the trade-off for you is to go with the present system rather than the way it was. Do you think there's still a role for private charity and mercy that is not compelled? Have we exhausted it? We have a need for the second mile kind of behavior, going beyond what the law requires, yeah. Okay, that would be along with her point that we've gone too far. It's become too easy to get public assistance. The hobo, or the tramp. We called them tramps, yeah, in the 30s in Iowa. I think where we've not been clear as a society is on whether certain people who receive public assistance ought to be required to work. We're still not decided on that. Should the single-parent household parent, usually a woman, a mother, who has young children, receiving aid to families with dependent children, should she be expected to work? Well, some of us say yes, no. Some say when her children are a certain age, her youngest child is 6 or her youngest child is 12. We have a continuing debate about that. But I don't know of many kinds of welfare that are available in our society to able-bodied people who are able to work and do not have dependents or disabilities. That's kind of a myth. I don't know of any other examples of people who are able to work who can get public assistance and have no dependents or no disabilities. Now, the one adult example where we debate is the welfare mother. Should she, is she getting too much of a free ride, or should she be expected to work? And there is a debate going on there. But apart from that, I can't think of any examples of people being made bums by the system. Both when there are two parents in a household, they're able to get welfare. And there are jobs available. Yeah. Well, I think that's an area, the so-called work-welfare relationship, that we haven't yet found good answers in our society. At the mercy. That's a good way to say it, yes. And the help giver can decide when to turn it on and off. That's the undependability of it. The other problem with it, maybe it's the same thing said in other words, is that the help giver tends to want to decide who's deserving and who's undeserving, and would make individual judgments based on any number of factors about who deserves my charity today and who does not deserve it.